Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, highlights from the 2014 American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting. Today is part one of a two-part series, and today's program is going to focus on a number of different types of cancers that our speakers are going to address in terms of the updates from this very important meeting. It happens every year, and people look forward to the information that is presented at this meeting. We also try to present this conference call right after the meeting as quickly as possible so that you can get the information from really experts. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in this topic in terms of getting really credible information about the different types of cancers and updates. We have over 1,523 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. We have participants from every part of the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Ireland, the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's activity was made possible by Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, also a contribution from Lilly, Novartis Oncology, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, and an educational donation provided by Amgen. And we really want to thank them for their support of these of this part one and part two of this series. And I also want to particularly thank them for their corporate collaboration and partnership in making today's program possible. Now, I'd like to turn your attention to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource for all of you. These are all, they all have toll-free numbers and websites that you can contact for additional information in addition to contacting Cancer Care. There also is information about our speakers and the topics that will be addressed. There is an evaluation form also included in your materials, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. Your feedback is really very important for us to continue to offer these programs. We'd like to hear what you think, what topics you'd like us to offer. Indeed, this workshop, this two-part series, is one that you've requested that we do year after year, and so we continue to present it to you. And there may be other topics that you'd like to see us present on, and we're very open to your ideas. Indeed, you are the best people to tell us what we should be offering. So we take your recommendations very seriously and, indeed, appreciate your feedback. Now, we have quite an amazing speakers today, really, just the best of the best. And we have seven presenters today on our call, and I'm going to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Criss, attending physician, Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Brien Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Criss is going to present a brief overview of lung cancer and the new treatment options presented at ASCO. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Criss.
Hello, I'm Mark Criss from Memorial Sloan Kettering. And I have just recently returned from the annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And I think, once again, all of us were humbled by the breadth of scientific discovery and also the increasing energy of all the participants there to try to translate ideas that come from laboratories to take new therapies and to get them to our patients and to find those patients that will benefit most from the new therapies that are coming available. I'm talking specifically about lung cancers, and once again, the meeting highlighted a huge number of developments in lung cancers, and I'll do my best to get through them in the next few minutes. I think the first message, again, is please note I keep using the word lung cancers. We have understood now, based on an improved knowledge of the illness by greater understanding of biology, that we are not dealing with one illness, we are dealing with many illnesses. And the more that we focus care on each specific type of lung cancer, the better we're going to have for the results for those patients and for the treatment of all lung cancers. I think most people were most excited about the development of agents specifically targeting the T790M, a resistant mutation in patients that have EGFR mutant lung cancers. As many of you know, 11 years ago, a number of hospitals discovered that mutations in the EGFR gene underlied the sensitivity of certain lung cancers to EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors like erlotinib and gefitinib. And that discovery broke open a whole new era in lung cancer therapy. We knew, though, that after a time, cancers learned how to circumvent the effectiveness of those drugs. And one of the prime ways they did that, in almost two-thirds of the patients, cancers escaped control by developing a second mutation, a mutation in the T790N gene, originally discovered by William Powell and Dr. Kobayashi from Dana-Farber. Scientists found drugs that specifically attacked those cancers that developed that second site mutation, and these drugs have now come into the clinic. And what we heard were three presentations at the ASCO meeting this year of three different drugs, all of which clearly met that promise that the drugs EZD9291, CO1686, and HM61713 all were given to people with these characteristics. There was clearly a shrinkage of cancer, and it appears to exceed more than half the patients have a major shrinkage. The side effects are always manageable and by and large less than what we see with gefitinib and erlotinib alone. So I think we're very hopeful that these drugs will quickly march through their clinical testing and through FDA approval and be available for patients. From the patient standpoint, this underlies the need for a second biopsy. So after you have been successfully treated with gefitinib, erlotinib, afatinib, when your cancer regrows, you need to get another biopsy. That biopsy will tell whether or not the T790M mutation is present. And if it is, these drugs are very likely to help you. If it is not, it will point your physicians in other directions to look for therapies that would hopefully target specific kinds of genetic changes in your cancer, which can also be detected by a re-biopsy. Also in the EGFR space, there was a very intriguing abstract from Japan that showed that adding bevacizumab to erlotinib at the start of therapy improved outcome for patients with single mutant sensitizing mutations in EGFR. I think this is a potentially practice-changing development where instead of just giving erlotinib or afatinib, physicians will now consider using bevacizumab, a universally available drug with that. The medicine combination appeared safe and appeared to be effective. The other information that was presented there was the use of crizotinib and ceritinib in patients with ALK positive lung cancers. There was a large clinical trial that showed that when comparing standard chemotherapy to crizotinib in patients that had ALK positive lung cancer, the crizotinib was a better choice. And a new drug approved a few weeks ago, ceritinib, was found to be effective in patients with ALK-positive lung cancers that had grown after treatment with crizotinib. Also, the data presented at ASCO this year suggested that the results giving ceritinib as the first treatment appeared to be slightly better than giving crizotinib, though there's more research that's going to need to be done on that. But again, additional hope for patients with other drugs, and other drugs are being tested as well. A drug called alectinib is now in clinical trial, so patients with these ALK mutant cancers can have benefit too. There was mixed news on the target MET, M-E-T. While giving a monoclonal antibody against the MET protein was shown not to be effective, the same drug, crizotinib, that was so effective in ALK mutant lung cancers and ROS1 mutant lung cancers appears to be effective in those cancers that have amplification of the MET gene. This is something that can be detected by a FISH test or detected by a multiplex testing that can be done now, part of, you know, next generation sequencing, as it's called. And if your doctors find that this MET amplification is present, then it's very likely that crizotinib, too, could be effective in fighting your cancer. Immune therapies were, again, on everybody's screen. We saw evidence of four different drugs, all of which target various aspects of the PD-L1 and PD-1 receptor complex, that these drugs appear to yield good shrinkages, often in patients that had not responded to other treatments, whose cancers had not responded to other treatments. There was data presented by my colleague, Dr. Rizvi, that giving these drugs first had activity closely approximating that of conventional intravenous chemotherapies. And also there was data about combining these new PD-L1 and PD-1 drugs with drugs targeting CTLA-4, drugs like ipilimumab or tremelimumab would also add benefit. So all this data was there in its early form. There's clear-cut benefit across all these trials, a spectrum of side effects that is different from the traditional IV chemotherapies, and I think clearly these drugs are going to provide benefit for many patients, and benefit that is likely to be additive to the success of other oral targeted therapies, intravenous chemotherapies, bevacizumab. There were some developments in the radiation field as well. There was an abstract from Korea where people that were found to have metastases to the brain that were not causing any symptoms could be managed by chemotherapy alone rather than moving to immediate radiation before chemotherapy. I think that is an important development, giving doctors that option of carefully treating with chemotherapy and carefully observing the responsive tumors in the brain, and reserving radiation only for those patients where the chemotherapy was unsuccessful or the tumors regrow after chemotherapy stopped working. There was also evidence provided in small cell lung cancers that giving radiation to the main originating point of the cancer in the chest after the completion of chemotherapy seemed to prolong the survival of patients with so-called extensive small cell lung cancer. In the past, we've only given radiation to the lung lesions in those patients where the cancer has been localized to the chest. Here, giving radiation in addition to standard chemotherapy appeared to help patients that had a good result with chemotherapy alone. And I think that's something that the doctors are going to be considering for their patients. And lastly, we had an educational session on the uses of chemotherapy. I know many have said that the targeted therapies only help those patients with the target, and that is true. With the immunotherapies, not every patient benefits, which is true. But chemotherapy is a treatment that can help virtually every patient. It can cure cancer with surgery. It can cure cancer when combined with radiation. And now chemotherapies have been found to be even more effective in people with driver oncogenes. They've been shown to be able to change the immune system in positive ways that would facilitate and enhance the effectiveness of the immune therapies. So standard chemotherapy, which is available right now, I think is going to be a very important tool to oncologists that will accelerate and enhance the benefit of the new therapies that are arriving day by day. So in summary, much hopeful news at ASCO this year. Drugs have been found to provide benefit where benefit was previously unavailable, provide benefit to more patients, and as drugs have become more targeted to cause less collateral damage to normal tissues. The sum total of this is that as more cancers shrink, for longer periods of time, and more cancers shrink with fewer adverse effects, because with targeted therapy, the normal tissues are less affected, it's ultimately going to lead to better lives for our patients with lung cancer. And I think I and many other investigators left that ASCO meeting with even more excitement and hope that more and more patients are going to live longer and live better because of the new treatments we have. And I'd like to return now to Dr. Messner to continue the presentation.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Chris, for just an excellent presentation and just an overview of lung cancer and all the latest treatments at ASCO. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Eunice Kwok. And Dr. Kwok is Assistant Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Assistant in Medicine, Hematology Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Kwok is going to be addressing colorectal cancer and the new treatment options presented at ASCO. It's my pleasure now to present to you Dr. Kwok, my pleasure to have Dr. Kwok present on this material. Dr. Kwok?
Hello, thank you very much. I will be giving an overview of the oral abstracts presented at the ASCO for colorectal cancer. The presented abstracts were thematically organized, answering what I found to be the practical questions that providers and patients face daily, involving three topics. Number one, treatment for locally advanced rectal cancer. Number two, the impact of colorectal cancer molecular status on systemic therapy options. And then three, chemotherapy maintenance strategies for metastatic colorectal cancer. There was also a presentation at the large plenary session on the results of a phase 3 trial comparing first-line chemotherapy regimens in the treatment of metastatic disease. Regarding the treatment of locally advanced rectal cancer, I'll discuss two abstracts addressing the role of oxaliplatin chemotherapy. Locally advanced rectal cancer is defined as clinically staged T2 or T3 disease, involving nodes or not involving nodes, without evidence of distant spread or disease, primarily determined on the basis of physical exam and radiologic imaging. The standard of care treatment for rectal cancer, unlike for resectable colon cancer, is a sandwich approach starting with chemotherapy combined with radiation, followed by surgical resection, followed by more chemotherapy or adjuvant therapy. It has been routine practice by many oncologists to include oxaliplatin with 5-FU leucovorin, often using the so-called FOLFOX regimen, in the final chemotherapy or adjuvant portion of that treatment course. This is an extrapolation from colon cancer adjuvant therapy treatment, but until now was not supported by specific trial data in locally advanced cancer. The first abstract, presented by Dr. Rodell from Germany, was a randomized phase 3 trial where one group of patients received oxaliplatin in addition to standard fluorouracil during chemoradiation and also during adjuvant chemotherapy outback after resection. The other group of patients received fluorouracil during radiation and subsequently fluorouracil without oxaliplatin after resection during adjuvant therapy. The endpoint or primary goal of the trial was to determine whether the addition of oxaliplatin did a better job of keeping patients free of disease when evaluated at a 3-year time point, and indeed, the addition of oxaliplatin improved disease-free survival at 3 years. Another abstract that was presented in the same session was presented by Dr. Hong from Korea. In this randomized phase 2 trial, all patients started with the same preoperative 5-FU with radiation regimen without oxaliplatin and then proceeded to surgical resection. If the microscopic pathology of the surgical resection indicated T3 or T4 disease or node-positive disease, then the patients were randomized to receive FOLFOX for 8 cycles or 5-FU leucovorin without oxaliplatin. At 3 years, a greater proportion of patients were free of disease if they had received FOLFOX as compared to patients who had received 5-FU leucovorin only. The conclusion drawn by the discussant for these abstracts, Dr. Carmen Allegra, is that the addition of oxaliplatin to adjuvant treatment following chemoradiation and resection is warranted based on improvement in disease-free survival. The next group of abstracts I'll talk about deal with the growing role of tumor molecular analysis in the determination of benefit from targeted therapy. There were two oral abstracts addressing testing for the RAS oncogene. In the case of cetuximab, the antibody that inhibits the epidermal growth factor receptor, we know that patients whose tumors harbor mutations at specific sites in the oncogene KRAS, namely at codons 12 and 13, that is in exon 2, the sites which are most routinely tested, these tumors with these mutations do not benefit from anti-EGFR therapy with cetuximab or the similar drug panitumumab. If patients have colorectal cancers that contain these mutations in KRAS, then cetuximab is not offered as a treatment option. The presented abstracts were a retrospective analysis of patient tumors enrolled on two large first-line metastatic colorectal cancer trials, one using cetuximab with FOLFOX and the other using cetuximab with FOLFIRI. Tumor samples were tested for additional mutations in KRAS besides the standard exon 2 mutations. For instance, exons 3 and 4 were tested, as well as in similar regions of the related RAS gene, NRAS. It was observed that these additional mutations, not previously routinely tested, also predicted lack of benefit to cetuximab therapy. Therefore, what is being termed expanded RAS testing can identify an additional subgroup of patients for whom cetuximab therapy should not be offered due to lack of benefit. Therefore, expanded RAS testing adds to the utility of existing KRAS data. It also adds to the growing knowledge regarding the role of molecular testing, for example, with respect to another oncogene with importance in colorectal cancer, BRAF, and guides us in how to use targeted therapies more effectively, providing the appropriate treatment to the appropriate cancers. In a somewhat related subject, in the plenary session, Dr. Alan Vinick reported on the results of a 10-year phase 3 trial with approximately 1,100 patients having KRAS wild-type colorectal cancer, addressing the question, what is the optimal first-line therapy for metastatic colorectal cancer? It really seems like a very straightforward question, but this trial was designed to answer this question definitively. Do the targeted agents bevacizumab or cetuximab work better with FOLFIRI or with FOLFOX? Because the use of FOLFIRI or FOLFOX was determined in the trial by the treating physician, most patients in the United States received FOLFOX because that tends to be the standard practice in this country. The results of the trial to date demonstrate that FOLFOX or FOLFIRI with either bevacizumab, the anti-angiogenic drug, or cetuximab were similar to each other in terms of overall survival. Therefore, the conclusion is that either regimen with either of the targeted agents is an effective choice in the first-line setting, and that factors such as differing side effects of the different components of therapy or patient preference should be taken into account when choosing a first-line regimen. The next two abstracts that I'll review address the treatment of metastatic colorectal cancer using chemotherapy maintenance strategies with bevacizumab as compared to observation. FOLFOX with the anti-angiogenic bevacizumab is a standard first-line regimen in the treatment of metastatic colorectal cancer, as was mentioned above. However, it is unknown what the optimal length of therapy is, and maintenance strategies using less intensive regimens containing various components of the regimen have been of interest. The first trial, presented by Dr. Arnold from Germany, used the following treatment scheme for metastatic colorectal cancer. All patients enrolled started with a 5-FU oxaliplatin regimen plus bevacizumab. If there was stable disease or improvement in disease after 6 months of therapy, then patients were randomized to one of three maintenance chemotherapy groups, 5-FU-based therapy with bevacizumab but without oxaliplatin, or bevacizumab alone, or observation without any chemotherapy or bevacizumab. At the time of progression, patients could then resume chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab and oxaliplatin. Patients receiving the more intensive maintenance regimen, which combined 5-FU with bevacizumab, though they did experience a longer time with that progression of disease than did patients who received bevacizumab alone or observation, when the overall survival time from the time of maintenance therapy was assessed, all the treatment arms were similar. That is, receiving 5-FU with bevacizumab, bevacizumab alone, and observation were similar in terms of overall survival. The second abstract addressed the concept of maintenance therapy in a phase 3 trial from the Netherlands. And in this trial, patients with metastatic colorectal cancer received 6 months of capecitabine plus oxaliplatin with bevacizumab. And if their disease was stable or better, then these patients were randomized to maintenance capecitabine with bevacizumab versus observation. and patients receiving maintenance therapy with capecitabine and bevacizumab, again, were free of progressive disease for a longer period of time from the start of the maintenance strategy. However, the overall survival in both the observation and the chemotherapy groups was similar. In discussion of these two abstracts, Dr. Leonard Saltz pointed out that there is value to treatment breaks or periods of time off chemotherapy that may not have been completely captured by these two trials. And given the fact that there was no overall survival benefit in the arms that used maintenance therapy containing chemotherapy, he concluded that the two trials did not provide any data arguing against treatment breaks, and that individualized treatment plans that include periods of observation in the midst of chemotherapy treatment for metastatic disease can be beneficial from the patient quality of life perspective. This is particularly relevant since multiple trials presented or reviewed at ASCO demonstrated that patients are living longer with multi-agent regimens and therefore are under treatment for longer periods of time. That concludes my comments on the oral presentations during the colorectal session at ASCO.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Kwok. That was really excellent and just really very an excellent snapshot for everybody of what was presented at ASCO on colorectal cancer. Thank you. And our next presenter is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly, and Dr. O'Reilly is Associate Attending Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Associate Professor, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. O'Reilly will be presenting on pancreatic cancer updates from ASCO. Dr. O'Reilly?
So thank you, Carolyn. This is Eileen O'Reilly. It's a pleasure to be here and to summarize the updates from ASCO 2014. I'll start by just summarizing the space of pancreas cancer treatments in general. We think about three stages of pancreas cancer: patients who've undergone surgery and are candidates for postoperative or adjuvant therapy, patients with localized pancreas cancer, which has not spread anywhere but is not operable. That's called locally advanced or sometimes borderline resectable pancreas cancer. That latter term extends into the spectrum of patients that might be candidates for future surgery. And then metastatic disease, which is when pancreas cancer has spread. So speaking to postoperative therapy, in North America, of the approximately 45,000 patients that are diagnosed, about 7,000 to 8,000 will be candidates for postoperative treatment. And postoperative standard treatment would include 6 months of gemcitabine or a 5-FU-based treatment, with also consideration of whether to include a combination of chemotherapy and radiation. That latter consideration is somewhat controversial in that there are data both supporting and negating the value of radiation, and that leads to one of the ongoing studies in North America, which is evaluating whether or not radiation should be routinely included in addition to chemotherapy-based treatment in the postoperative setting. Other studies underway in the postoperative setting include combining new drugs, for example, a drug called nab-paclitaxel, which we'll touch on in a minute, related to metastatic pancreas cancer, is being evaluated combined with gemcitabine postoperatively, and an ongoing study in Europe is combining an oral version of 5-FU to gemcitabine. And all of these studies are actively recruiting, and it'll be several years before we have new data. So from ASCO 2014, we don't have a new direction right now in terms of postoperative treatment, but hopefully over the coming couple of years we'll have additional insight. So moving to localized but not operable pancreas cancer, last year at ASCO we had data discussing where radiation fits in localized but not operable pancreas cancer. And results from the LAPO7, a large European study which included approximately 400 patients with localized pancreas cancer, evaluated the addition of erlotinib, which is an oral targeted medication, to gemcitabine, and also evaluated the addition of radiation to a gemcitabine-based therapy. And there were two major conclusions: one, that erlotinib didn't add, and secondly, that radiation didn't appear to improve the number of people who were alive at a certain time point, although there was no negative impact from the radiation. And this year, in 2014, we had some refinements of this data suggesting that the inclusion of radiation offered the ability to slow down the rate at which the cancer regrew in the localized pancreas area, and it also provided patients with an additional period of time off of treatment. So this speaks to the theme of quality of life, and time off treatment can be considered as a quality of life important consideration. So these data suggest to us that there remains a group of people in whom the inclusion of radiation in localized pancreas cancer is helpful, and ongoing analyses from this large study will hopefully give some further clues as to which might be the best subset of patients for whom we should be routinely considering the inclusion of radiation as part of their treatment in the setting of localized pancreas cancer. So moving on to metastatic disease, and perhaps as many are aware, most patients who are diagnosed with pancreas cancer will have evidence of spread of the disease at diagnosis, with the common sites including the liver, the inner lining of the abdominal cavity, and the lungs, and less commonly the bones. And in this setting of pancreas cancer, the mainstay of treatment is not surgery and not radiation, but is systemic therapy or chemotherapy, with the goals being to get the best control of the cancer, to have a given person feeling as well as possible for as long as possible, and to shrink the disease and to ease symptoms from the cancer. There are two main standard treatments for patients with metastatic pancreas cancer who have a high level of functioning. FOLFIRINOX is a combination of medications which derived from a large study in Europe, and more recently in North America, a combination of gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel has provided a new reference standard also. These latter data from gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel were presented at last year's ASCO meeting, and these data were updated this year, and showing that the combination of gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, as we follow patients on the study out now in a number of years, that in general people who received the combination had improved control of their disease and had improved survival over gemcitabine. And additional data from further analyses of the study suggested that patients who might have what we would consider poor risk disease, so maybe more bulky disease, a very high CA19-9, which is a blood test which can give an indication of the burden of cancer, that those patients may fare better from the combination compared to patients who received gemcitabine. So moving to new data in metastatic disease, an important study evaluating a drug called ruxolitinib was presented. And ruxolitinib is a drug that interferes with inflammation pathways that are important in cancer, and we know for a long time are particularly important in people with pancreas cancer, and inflammation may account for part of the circumstances that we see in clinical practice in terms of weight loss, loss of muscle mass, decline in level of functioning. All of these symptoms and consequences of the disease are in part related to the heightened inflammation and immunity that's activated in pancreas cancer. And ruxolitinib targets these immune and inflammatory pathways. And data evaluating ruxolitinib in a second-line setting, that was in patients with metastatic pancreas cancer who had received prior gemcitabine, went on to receive either a combination of capecitabine, which is an oral 5-FU drug, which is a standard consideration in the second-line setting, combined with ruxolitinib, or capecitabine combined with a placebo. And the data showed that for the overall analysis of the study, there was not an obvious benefit to the addition of ruxolitinib, but in a subgroup of patients, which was about half of the patients, and this was a pre-planned analysis, and these were patients who had an elevation of CRP, which is a substance that's measured in the blood that can be an indicator of inflammation in cancer, and this has been looked at over the years and has been shown to be valuable in potentially predicting outcome in cancer, but it's really the first time that it's been studied in a prospective way in pancreas cancer specifically. And in this group of patients who had a high level of CRP, there was benefit to the combination of ruxolitinib combined with capecitabine. And I think that's very encouraging because it gives a signal, again, that issues pertaining to quality of life and issues pertaining to inflammation, to muscle mass, to weight maintenance, that targeting those considerations in pancreas cancer can be very relevant. And it's sort of been hoped that this would be true for a long period of time, but this is the first, I think, concrete clue that this is a potentially valuable strategy. So going forward, there are two large studies that are designed that are phase three trials, that one of which is already opened, and both of these studies are designed to replicate the signal and hopefully validate this in the subgroup of patients who seem to benefit in the phase two, and that's the group of people who have a high CRP or a modified Glasgow prognostic score, which is on the higher range, and that looks at both a combination of CRP and the albumin or the protein level in the blood and combines those into a classification for patients. So I think going forward, we're going to see a lot more information on the use of CRP in pancreas cancer, and one might anticipate that this could become a stratification factor for trials. So for the last couple of minutes, I'll just highlight a couple of other areas in pancreas cancer for which new data was presented. One is, in a previously treated pancreas cancer setting in metastatic disease, evaluating the addition of oxaliplatin to a combination of 5-FU and leucovorin. This was a Canadian study that suggested, in contrast to a prior signal, that there was not an obvious benefit to the addition of oxaliplatin in a setting of previously treated pancreas cancer. This is in distinct contrast to the use of oxaliplatin in a frontline pancreas cancer setting where we know it has value as it is one of the reference standards for FOLFIRINOX for high-functioning patients. Other data, and we don't have the full report on this yet, but coming at a meeting later this month in June, will be information on a drug called MM398, which is it's called liposomal irinotecan. It's irinotecan is a standard drug that has established value in the treatment of pancreas cancer, and this is a new formulation of that drug. And data which has been released, just indicating the high line, suggests that this drug combined with 5-FU and leucovorin, again in a previously treated pancreas cancer setting, has value, and there's the potential that this may add in terms of new treatment options. This was in the context of a phase three trial comparing to 5-FU on its own. So I think more to come in that area. And lastly, to say that there was additional information presented on immunotherapy trials, a number that are underway in pancreas cancer. We know already that there are hints that immune-based therapies may have a role for people with pancreas cancer, and I wouldn't say we had a lot of data this year, but hopefully over the next 18 months we're going to learn where immune therapies may fit in the treatment of pancreas cancer. So that's the summary from ASCO 2014, and we'll be glad to take questions. Thank you
so much, Dr. Riley. That was a wonderful presentation, Dr. O'Reilly, and we really appreciate your overview and presentation of the findings at ASCO on pancreatic cancer. And our next speaker is Dr. John Leonard. Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Associate Dean for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Medical College, Vice Chairman of Medicine for Clinical Research, Associate Director, Cancer Center, Chief Lymphoma Service, Attending Physician, York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Leonard is going to present on lymphoma. It's my pleasure now to introduce to you Dr. Leonard.
Good afternoon, and it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. And I would first like to start by thanking Cancer Care and the other organizers for the opportunity to present to you today these updates from the ASCO meeting in Chicago. So in the next few minutes, I will focus on lymphoma and related blood cancers. As this audience likely knows, lymphoma is a tumor of the lymph cells, the lymphoid cells, and is comprised primarily of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas and Hodgkin's lymphomas as a group. So at the ASCO meeting, there were a smattering of different presentations that were focused on a couple of aspects of new areas of lymphoma treatment, and I'll briefly give you a little bit of an overview of some of them. And it's interesting because some of the issues that we face in lymphomas are also issues that are faced in other cancers, and in many ways lymphoma somehow leads the way as far as developing new treatments and some of the challenges and opportunities that we have going on as we approach these treatments. So the first area I want to talk about relates to Hodgkin lymphoma, and actually Hodgkin lymphoma is one of the more favorable in some ways types of lymphoma from the standpoint of the effectiveness of chemotherapy. However, there are some patients where chemotherapy and radiation treatments are less effective and newer treatments are needed. There has been a new drug approved by the FDA recently, a drug called brentuximab vedotin, which is the combination of an antibody treatment, an immune protein that binds to the tumor cells and has attached to it a toxin molecule, essentially a chemotherapy that is targeted toward the tumor cells. And we'll come back to this a little bit later in a different context, as well as this is an area that is related to other types of cancer because these antibody drug conjugate, basically the drug hooked to an antibody that delivers these immune proteins, deliver the tumor cells through the blood more specific, deliver the toxin or drug more specifically to the tumor cells, is really a novel and important new type of cancer therapy. So brentuximab vedotin is an antibody drug conjugate that is FDA approved for patients with relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma, where it can be a very effective and useful treatment. So what was presented at the ASCO meeting was a very small but very intriguing study that said, well, most patients with Hodgkin lymphoma are treated with chemotherapy. A combination of drugs called ABVD is the standard treatment. What if we use this antibody drug conjugate called brentuximab vedotin instead of chemotherapy or before chemotherapy? And so the idea is that if you can use this targeted chemotherapy in patients with relapsed or recurrent disease and it works pretty well, why not use it earlier in the course of the disease? And there are a number of studies combining this drug with chemotherapy. This was a small Italian study that basically treated newly diagnosed Hodgkin lymphoma patients with the antibody drug conjugate for a couple of cycles of treatment, and then afterwards gave the patients the chemotherapy. And the bottom line of this study, which you can't draw huge conclusions about, suggested that using this antibody drug conjugate rather than chemotherapy as the first initial treatment in newly diagnosed patients could actually be quite effective. Most patients who were treated on this, it's a small study, actually had excellent responses as measured by PET scans. So the exciting part, this is not something that's going to change treatment today. I don't think a patient diagnosed today with Hodgkin lymphoma should be treated any differently than they would be otherwise. But it really makes the point that before too long, I think in Hodgkin lymphoma and in other cancers, rather than using chemotherapy, we may use this targeted chemotherapy in the form of antibody drug conjugates to either reduce the amount of chemotherapy, potentially delay chemotherapy, or ultimately perhaps replace chemotherapy. So again, this was a small study in Hodgkin lymphoma using an antibody drug conjugate, brentuximab vedotin, as initial treatment for Hodgkin lymphoma, and again, following that with chemotherapy. And so that is a very interesting new approach, again, putting chemotherapy potentially aside. And this was an example of several other antibody drug conjugates that were reported upon at the ASCO meeting. One of these was also, actually two of these were presented in the setting of B-cell lymphomas, and a different target, something called CD19, which is a target, a molecule on B-cell lymphomas, not Hodgkin lymphomas, but B-cell lymphomas, including diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which is the most common form of lymphoma. This antibody-drug conjugate, where an antibody, an immune protein that targets the lymphoma cells, has attached to it a drug, so the antibody is delivering the drug more specifically to the tumor cells. There were two of these antibody-drug conjugates studied targeting CD19 on B-cell lymphomas, including diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, showing that these could be active treatments, they could shrink the disease in a subgroup of patients. And so, in fact, again, the theme, I think, of lymphoma that was presented or relating to lymphoma is that not only do we have the brentuximab for Hodgkin lymphoma, but we'll have several other new antibody drug conjugates that are moving through clinical trials that may be also applicable for B-cell lymphomas, including diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, again, the most common subtype of lymphoma. We now have antibody drug conjugates also approved in breast cancer as well. And so this is a theme of treatment that I think patients should take care of and monitor. And I think from the perspective of patients, this is interesting because instead of giving chemotherapy that targets all of the cells of the body more specifically or more effectively against the tumor cells but causes side effects elsewhere, the idea of these antibody drug conjugates is really to direct the chemotherapy more specifically to the tumor and less to the normal cells, and that may potentially result in less side effects, better quality of life potentially, and hopefully more effective targeting of the tumor. So that's one major theme of lymphoma that I think is important to take out, the idea of new drugs and antibody drug conjugates. The second and other major area that I think is a theme that patients should be interested in lymphoma and relating to lymphoma, which also relates to other cancers, is the idea of how do we monitor a patient who's at risk of relapsing at some point in the future? How do we monitor them after therapy? And every cancer that we deal with, that comes up as an issue. You get diagnosed, you get a treatment. The treatment is effective. What do we do after that? Do we monitor the patients? Do we do scans? What do we do, and how can we use that to most effectively plan for the future for an individual patient? And so there were a couple of studies in lymphoma that were focused on this issue. One of these took patients with also diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and evaluated that group of patients that had been treated with chemotherapy, and that is a disease setting where many people, not all, but many people are cured of their disease after they complete treatment, and that's typically a combination of chemotherapy called CHOP and rituximab treatment. And this study looked at those patients in remission and evaluated a blood test that takes blood samples from the patient, looks at the blood, looks for traces of DNA that could be coming from the tumor cells, and at a very sensitive level is looking for DNA in the tumor cells, and essentially suggests that this test may be something that has value in monitoring a patient after treatment. And so the beauty of this test, if it pans out, and I would say it has a long way to go because these tests need to be studied prospectively in a large number of patients, and ultimately one needs to be able to act on this in a meaningful way to benefit patients, not just to say, yes, you're at risk of relapse or no, you're not at relapse, but actually turn that information into something we can act on. But it suggests that this may provide a blood test that can identify someone who's at risk of relapsing, perhaps someone who needs to be followed more closely, perhaps someone who needs more scanning to track their disease, and ultimately perhaps someone who will need some sort of intervention to try to delay or prevent or deal with a relapse that might be coming. And so this is, I think, a very interesting thing. It's very early in the course of study, so don't go to your doctor tomorrow saying, I want the lymphoma DNA blood test, because it's something that's not ready for prime time, but it raises the idea that for too long, we may have additional blood tests, which is something that we look for in all cancers, tests that can hopefully identify early relapse, risk of relapse, and give us a tool to use to try to treat patients. There were also data in follicular lymphoma, the most common of the indolent lymphomas, suggesting that PET scanning at the end of treatment, an imaging test, can be very helpful in predicting and measuring how people will do, and potentially down the line can be used to guide treatment, i.e., if a patient gets a therapy and their PET scan looks very good, that's a good sign. If a patient doesn't have a very good PET scan or has a partially better PET scan but not completely better PET scan, that may be someone we need to watch more closely or do something with. So that, I think, is another second key theme about lymphoma that came out of ASCO, is how can we monitor patients better and have more tools to monitor patients in order to improve their outcomes. And then finally, just as with every meeting these days in the rapidly changing field of oncology and lymphoma in particular, we had lots of information on new drugs, how to use older drugs in a more effective fashion. I think none of these pieces of data were things that are going to change how we treat patients today, but I think provide reason for optimism that we'll continue to have new tools available to treat patients, new options for patients, and ultimately options that will be more effective and improve quality of life so that patients can have control or effective treatment of their disease without some of the side effects that are challenges for our existing treatments. So with that, I think I'll stop. And again, I'd like to thank you for participating in this program and for the opportunity to give you some of the highlights of the ASCO meeting relating to lymphomas. And again, encourage you all to stay tuned, because I think there are lots of exciting and promising things happening in this research area. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Leonard, for just excellent presentation on lymphoma and all of the updates from ASCO. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. And Dr. Morrow is leader, Myeloproliferative Diseases Program, member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Morrow is going to present on leukemia. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. Boy, we heard a lot of information so far, and there's more to come. And in the next few minutes, I'll cover some of the information we learned at ASCO 2014 in leukemia, particularly focusing on an area that I follow very closely, which would be the area of CML and myeloproliferative disorders, and as well a little bit on CLL. As many of you know, ASCO is a meeting that focuses on oncology, and when it comes to blood cancers, there may be a little bit less information, but we certainly had some important updates on certain medications and clinical studies, and as well some new information to share. So in looking first at CML, we've seen clearly a revolution in CML. We have taken a disease that had a limited number of treatment options, where many patients were advised to move to stem cell transplant, or to receive older but somewhat effective therapies. We now have a quite treatable disease with very long follow-up from some of our earliest options, those being the targeted drugs blocking BCR-ABL, or the Philadelphia chromosome product, with Gleevec being the prototype medication, and now four other drugs which have come since Gleevec to round out a repertoire of orally available kinase inhibitors for CML. And in ASCO 2014, we actually had information on sort of our first medication, imantinib, and looking back now 10 years of treatment, and actually a fair bit of information on our latest medication, ponatinib, and some important information helping us understand a little bit better about how that medication may be best used. So in thinking about imantinib, there were two presentations at ASCO this year, one from a very large study in Germany presented by Dr. Hellman, which looked at the how well Gleevec performed over, again, 10 years treatment in a very large trial, which used Gleevec as the base of treatment. Patients either got Gleevec or higher doses of Gleevec or Gleevec in combination with lower doses of older medications like interferon and cytarabine. The MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston has done a fair bit of research in CML, as many of you know, and there was a presentation as well from that group by Dr. Sasaki looking at 10 years of follow-up for patients treated with either standard or higher doses of Gleevec. Since the beginning of research with Gleevec and CML, we've had a question about what is the optimal dose. And these two studies helped shed light on a few important questions. First, the German study looked at the safety and long-term efficacy. And this is important as Gleevec stands as an option tried and true over time, and we know that may become a lower-cost option in the next year or two. So the long-term safety of imatinib in this German CML study was the most robust and favorable amongst the orally available kinase inhibitors. They didn't see any complications in the realm of what are called arterial or venous or vascular events that were attributable to imatinib, and that's an important question currently. They did notice that some of the common side effects like swelling and gastrointestinal toxicities do increase with higher doses. Perhaps a bit of a word of caution as we continue to explore higher doses or more potent therapies. And that definitely the cumulative responses and that adverse events diminish with time. So the longer patients are on treatment, deeper remissions occur and side effects tend to be less likely to occur. This data has been backed up by other large studies, such as a randomized trial of Gleevec versus interferon and a study just looking at side effects for patients with CML. The second study regarding Gleevec was looking at standard versus higher doses in CML. And while it did show that some of the important early milestones or expectations of response we have for patients, such as early PCR or molecular-based response, or later or deeper molecular response, including what's called a major or a complete molecular response, where the disease is anywhere from 1,000 to 50,000 times smaller than the start, were higher with patients those were more likely in patients who had higher doses of Gleevec. However, when we look at both groups, they both did very well, and it's hard for us to discern that whether the improved response has changed the overall outcome. Basically, a bit of a good problem that both the 400 and the 800 milligram groups have similar, exceedingly high rates of managing their CML, being in remission and surviving without having the complication of transformation or other complications developing. So we still have this question regarding how much the improved response rates will impact the long-term outcome, which is exceedingly optimistic for patients with CML, even on imatinib or Gleevec. And this has been correlated in other trials as well, where we've tried to look at higher doses of Gleevec to see if they would improve the outcome in the long term, or the quote on the big picture of overall survival and not having the CML return or proliferate again. And those still haven't been proven yet, but stay tuned. There were several trials looking at how to optimize treatment. And just in a word, there was a trial showing that if for patients who are on Gleevec who have residual evidence of CML beyond what we'd like, so they don't have a molecular response after 2 years of treatment, they may benefit from switching to a drug like nilotinib, which is a drug derived from Gleevec and which is able to treat intolerance and resistance and may optimize people's response if Gleevec didn't put someone into the deepest of remissions early on. And these patients were still in cytogenetic remission, so doing well, but the question would be, would a deeper remission help them benefit over the long term and maybe even allow them to stop treatment? There was also a presentation on how ponantinib, which is a drug I'll talk about again a bit more in a moment, how it might have performed in the frontline setting. It was a randomized trial comparing ponantinib, the only of the third generation or third wave of drugs developed. And this ponantinib was developed to work in settings where all the other available therapies were unable to bring on or restore remission, and select types of mutations where certain mutations such as a position 315 or 315 mutation are present and it blocks the ability of drugs to bind. That's where ponantinib was developed for, but it was brought all the way into the frontline setting and compared to imatinib. And some of the data was quite impressive that ponantinib could bring the overwhelming majority of patients into a passed the first milestone of response at 3 months, and they even put people into deep molecular remission as early as 3 to 6 months. Now, that trial was stopped because of some of the side effect questions we had about penantinib. And as many of you know, there was a brief time when penantinib wasn't available while data was reexamined. We now know that there are higher rates of vascular or arterial and venous adverse events with penantinib, and these are under careful investigation right now with regards to why they occur, how we can best manage the risk, and how we might be able to move on and continue to harness the power of some of our more potent inhibitors. We've looked critically at all of our drugs in CML, and many of them have some late effects or late side effects. And so penantinib's not the only one. For example, nilotinib has a more modest but also an increase over Gleevec, for example, in the likelihood of having an arterial or venous adverse event. So the advice currently would be for to be quite aware of these side effects, and really for us to think of CML as a truly a chronic illness where people can be treated and over a long period of time are very likely to go in remission, and we really have to pay attention to their overall health. Not that we weren't before, but we need to pay even more close attention now as we may have some strategies to reduce risk of adverse events that could be medication-related or a mix of both the patient's underlying risk and some effects from the medication. And the good news that patients are living with CML and are going to survive their disease. So those are some of the important things we learned about some of the kinase inhibitors ranging from imantinib to penantinib. The future for penantinib, just in a word, is that a study will soon be available where we'll look at reduced doses and the concept of using a higher dose in the beginning and then lowering that dose over time to improve balance between risk and benefit in order to still help patients get back into remission if they lost it or weren't able to get it on currently available medications and lower the risk of side effects. There was one important study presented on in the area of myeloproliferative disorders. Ruxolitinib or Jakafi was a medication FDA approved for the patients with myelofibrosis. And we know that there are other targets and other pathways that may be active in this condition. And there have been studies both in the U.S. and in Europe combining other treatments with ruxolitinib or Jakafi, and a drug called panobinostat, which is a histone deacetylase inhibitor, may offer some synergy, meaning better than just the two drugs individually, their effect in this condition, and maybe provide patients with deeper response in the setting of myelofibrosis. So I think the side effects in this early study were predictable, as we might have expected with these medications, mainly in the GI tract and lowering the blood counts. But we saw even better spleen responses and the potential that we might be able to see reduction in the abnormal cells, the JAK2 mutated cells, which we think are driving the disease. In the last few minutes, I'm going to turn to another one of the blood cancers covered at ASCO, and that would be CLL. And I think there were several important reports in this realm. We just heard Dr. Leonard talk about lymphoma and some of the other lymphoid cancers, but in CLL particularly, three things to point out. And that would be first, report of a longer follow-up from a phase 1 study of a medication called ABT-199. So there are many new targets that have been identified in CLL that are quite promising, and this one is against something called BCL2, and that's something that controls whether a CLL cell is going to undergo programmed cell death or terminate itself or not. So this inhibits the cell's ability to keep itself alive through this mechanism. And this phase 1 study has shown incredibly encouraging results, and this is hopefully something that we'll be able to move forward and study in greater depth in the phase 2 trials and maybe find the right place for its use in CLL. But the majority of patients had responses to this drug, and about a quarter of patients had what was called a complete remission, perhaps not with complete blood recovery, but and even some of those patients had their minimal residual disease or the residual evidence of their CLL disappear. As well, the patients enrolled in this trial often had some of the more difficult to treat CLL with changes in chromosome 17, which is related to something called P53, which is known to make CLL more challenging to treat. And as well, patients who had already had a medicine called fludarabine and hadn't responded to that or hadn't had a lasting remission. So that was quite encouraging. On the same theme, there was a study looking at one of the other new drugs that's been reported in the papers, called idelalisib, and this is a drug which is a more like Gleevec, if you will, in that it's a kinase inhibitor. It blocks something called the PI3 kinase delta form, and this drug was looked at in the same population of difficult-to-treat CLL, those that have abnormalities in the P53 pathway or chromosome 17, and other what we would call more risky scenarios. And in analyzing the data that's already been published on idelalisib, the results were quite encouraging, that the patients with more difficult-to-treat CLL really do benefit from this new agent. Lastly, in the area of CLL, there was a second trial looking at a drug called ibrutinib, which is targeting yet another area of CLL, something called Bruton's tyrosine kinase, which is crucial to CLL cell survival. And this kinase inhibitor was compared to a newer antibody that is used in CLL called ofatumumab, which is like rituximab, it blocks CD20. And when these two medications were compared, antibody therapy like ofatumumab and rituximab have been quite standard and quite beneficial in CLL. But we're really seeing benefits from these newer targeted therapies, and ibrutinib really improved the progression-free and overall survival dramatically in this comparative study. This study was launched when some of the preliminary data showed the improvements that ibrutinib could generate in other populations. So the benefits from this family of targeted therapies in CLL really can't be underestimated, and I think I'd advise everyone to stay tuned to that area. And I think we're seeing, if you will, a convergence of our focus on targeted therapy in blood cancers and in solid tumors as well, as you heard from my colleagues. And I'm quite encouraged that the long-term results from patients with CML is maybe leading the way and helping us ask the proper questions about safety and long-term benefit. And we're seeing much more exciting developments or many exciting developments in our other blood cancers and other solid tumors. So thanks for your attention, and stay tuned for yet more data from ASCO in just a moment.
Thank you so much, Dr. Moore. That was an exquisite, excellent presentation. Thank you so much. And we appreciate your updates from ASCO on leukemia. And our next presenter is Dr. Frances Worden. Dr. Worden is Associate Professor, Lead Medical Oncologist, Head and Neck Oncology, University of Michigan. And Dr. Worden is going to be presenting on ASCO updates on oral and head and neck cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Worden.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'm happy to be here today to discuss these abstracts. First, I want to break down the abstracts by category or type of head and neck cancer. So the first part of my discussion will be about those cancers that are squamous cell carcinomas arising from the tongue, the voice box, the lip, etc., as compared to thyroid cancers which come from the thyroid gland. So I'll talk about a novel strategy later in the discussion. But first of all, a little background about head and neck cancer. As we're learning now in the last several years, there are two distinct types of head and neck cancer. So we're talking about, the base of tongue or tonsil or voice box cancer. There are those who are HPV positive and those that are HPV negative. The HPV negative represents about 70 to 75% of all these squamous cell cancers. And they are, when we look under the microscope, what we describe from the pathologist as a keratinizing tumor. They're more common in men as compared to women and more common in older people. Alcohol and tobacco are the number one and two risk factors for developing these HPV-negative tumors. HPV-positive tumors, on the other hand, represent about 25 to 30% of all squamous cell carcinomas and involve primarily cancers of the tonsil as well as the base of tongue or back part of the tongue as known as the vallecula. These are more basaloid, which means these cancers under the microscope look very flowery and grow very quickly, and people oftentimes will recognize a mass in the neck that grows very quickly. They're more common in younger patients, meaning that the median or average time when these cancers show up is the 50s as compared to perhaps the later 60s or 70s with the HPV-negative cancers. Men are more common to get these cancers, and they're linked to actually sexual behavior. So in our teens, when people become sexually active, they're engaging in intercourse and oral sexual activity, which puts them at higher risk to develop these HPV infections in the mouth and tonsil, and then later on, about 15, 20, 30 years later, to develop these cancers. Although it's a concerning thing, it does represent a very small minority of these cancers, but still enough that we warrant vaccinating all our youth. So patients who have children ages 9 to 12 who have not been vaccinated with HPV vaccine, we are definitely recommending vaccination for those patients. And the good news is the HPV-related tumors actually have a better survival. So with that as a background, I'm going to talk about four abstracts related to squamous cell carcinomas of the head and neck. And the first one has to do with treatment of what they call locally advanced disease, so cancer that is in either the tonsil, back part of tongue, voice box, and has perhaps spread to the lymph nodes in the neck, but nowhere else in the body. Those patients are treated with chemotherapy and radiation therapy to control and hopefully cure their cancers. There was an abstract presented that discussed treatment with cisplatin plus radiation or cetuximab in radiation therapy. And in this particular abstract or study, they did what they call a meta-analysis, where they pool multiple studies of cetuximab and radiation together with cisplatin and radiation. And why this is important is because we don't have what they call randomized prospective data yet to date telling us whether cisplatin and radiation is better than cetuximab and radiation. So studies like this are very important because they give us an idea as what we should be doing now in 2014. And from this abstract, we've learned that cisplatin and radiation continues to be the standard of care. Does not mean that cetuximab and radiation can't be given, but when you present to your doctor's office and they have a discussion about treatment of locally advanced, so those local cancers that need to be treated with chemotherapy and radiation therapy, cisplatin and radiation would be considered standard and what most practitioners would be considered the front line of treatment. If patients aren't candidates for cisplatin, then cetuximab and radiation can be used as an alternative. While we're talking about cetuximab, there was a study done several years ago, presented at ASCO, and then published in the New England Journal by Dr. James Bonner, that showed us that cetuximab and radiation was better than radiation therapy alone. As I've alluded to earlier, there has not been a study comparing cisplatin and radiation versus cetuximab and radiation, but in this particular abstract, we wanted to learn more about HPV and results of treatment with cetuximab and radiation therapy. So in this study, the investigators went back and looked at patients who were HPV positive and those that were HPV negative. And what they found is that people who are HPV positive, as we've known now for a few years, do much better with chemotherapy and radiation therapy as compared to people who are HPV negative when treated with chemotherapy and radiation therapy. What they also found out was that HPV is considered a prognostic marker, meaning that we know people will do better, but it is not a predictive marker of who should receive the cetuximab and radiation therapy as the mainstay of treatment. So again, to recap, as it is right now, cisplatin and radiation would be the main standard of care and an alternative to treatment of your cancer up front that is locally advanced would be cetuximab and radiation therapy. Additionally, people who did the best with treatment with cetuximab and radiation therapy were those patients who had what they call oropharynx cancers, or those cancers that were HPV positive related to the tonsil or the back part of the tongue. Moving onward to discuss a little bit more about HPV therapy, we know, as I said earlier, people with HPV positive disease do better with their treatments. Their survivals are much better, and their responses to chemotherapy and radiation therapy are much better. But the question comes up, can we get by with less treatment, meaning that we know side effects exist from radiation therapy and chemotherapy, and since people do so well, we want to try to preserve quality of life. Can we do that if we actually reduce the intensity of radiation therapy? So in this particular abstract, there was a group from around the country, took patients and gave them some chemotherapy up front because they wanted to see if they did well. And these were patients who were all HPV positive. No HPV negative, all HPV positive patients. They were treated with chemotherapy with three cycles of cetuximab, cisplatin, and another medication called docetaxel. When these were given every 3 weeks for three times, if patients had a complete response, which means their cancer, when they repeated their x-rays or CT scans, all went away, they went on to receive cetuximab with radiation therapy. The radiation therapy dose was 54 gray, so a lower dose than our standard dose, which is 70 gray. they chose to use cetuximab because the side effects from previous studies with cetuximab are much less than that when cisplatin is given with radiation therapy. So again, this isn't considered a standard of care, but a clinical trial. And what they found is last year at ASCO, they presented data suggesting that people with the lower amount of radiation did just as well as people with higher amounts of radiation. Because on this particular study, if you didn't respond to those three cycles of chemotherapy up front, you went to receive the standard dose of radiation therapy with cetuximab. So what's interesting this year is we now have data 1 year later showing us that at 2 years, people who receive some chemotherapy and have a good or excellent response to the treatment can go on to receive lower doses of radiation therapy with cetuximab as compared to people who don't respond. But what we should point out here is that this is still an experimental treatment, and it was done in a small cohort of patients, which means it suggests that we should go ahead and be exploring this treatment option further, but it does not mean this is standard of care, which means, as other investigators and doctors have talked about today, it's something you shouldn't go into your doctor's office saying, I want lesser dose of radiation therapy, because we still don't have all the data to say whether or not this should become a standard of care. What will be presented at ASCO probably next year will be a study actually comparing cetuximab and radiation therapy to cisplatin radiation therapy in the same population of patients who are HPV positive and have tonsil and back part of the tongue cancers. So this will give us a better idea if people can get cetuximab and radiation that actually causes a little bit less side effects as compared to cisplatin, and we'll see if those two treatment arms are equivalent. Hopefully that will help to advance the standards so we can treat people with perhaps a better quality of life and better side effects. Moving on to the fourth and final abstract in the squamous cell carcinomas of the head and neck was a presentation given by Dr. Tangi Seewert from the University of Chicago, and this centers around immunotherapy. So some of the other doctors have been talking about immunotherapy thus far. And so to simplify it here, there are certain proteins that are expressed on all kinds of tumor cells, and there's one in particular called PD-L1, and this is expressed on the tumor cells as well as macrophages, or those cells that help to clean up the immune system. And when they're expressed, they can suppress immune surveillance, so it's kind of suppress the immune system. What we found when we study them in mice is that antibodies blocking these proteins, these PD-1 or PD-L1 proteins, can have an interaction which leads to tumor regression. So there was a study done at the University of Chicago that was presented this year using a medication called pembrolizumab, formerly known as this numeric as MK-3475. Again, this is an antibody, like some of our other doctors have been talking about, against this PD-1 protein. And what they did in this cell, or this study, is they gave the treatment by IV to patients, and they looked at both HPV-positive and HPV-negative patients. And this was what they call a phase 1 study. So they were looking at some responses, but they were also looking at side effects. And what they found is that people who were receiving the medication had to have had expression of this protein on their tumor. So they took their tumor and they sent it to the laboratory to see if they were actually expressing this protein. And if so, they received the medication. As a result of the study, they found that people were able to tolerate the treatment relatively well, meaning that the main side effects included fatigue, some itching, as one would expect with an immunologic kind of treatment, some rash, and a little bit of nausea. We don't have long-term outcome results because this is a study mainly looking to check out side effects at different dosages of this medication. But they did report that about 50% or so of patients did have some kind of decrease in their tumor burden. What this means is yet unknown. We saw it in both the HPV positive as well as HPV negative patients, but more studies will definitely need to be done in order for us to actually bring this field of immunotherapy forward. So as it's been stated before, stay tuned, because I think this is a very interesting area that could actually have a lot of promise. Dr. Seward did report in one particular patient who was actually doing very poorly and considering entering into hospice care, received the medication and had a great resolution of his tumor. So this was one particular patient had a good response, which means not everybody may or may not respond. But nonetheless, again, it's promising, and we'll have to continue studying this to lead the field forward, as I alluded to. Finally, shifting gears to thyroid cancer. So this year at ASCO, there was an exciting abstract that was presented using the drug lenvatinib. And lenvatinib is known as a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, so inhibiting a key enzyme or protein in the thyroid cancer cells that leads to breakdown of the tumor or causes the tumor to die. Last year at ASCO, Dr. Marcia Bros presented a plenary or at the large session, an abstract showing the benefits of a drug called sorafenib, which is also a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, over placebo, because we don't really have a standard of care yet for thyroid cancers, and these cancers often will smolder and go for a long period of time, and patients are asymptomatic and don't require treatment. What she showed last year is that when compared to placebo, the progression-free survival, or the amount of time where the cancer stayed still and didn't grow, was about 5 months. This year, with this new drug called lenvatinib, we saw an 18-month improvement in progression-free survival as compared to placebo. So this was a very, very robust response for a similar kind of drug. We also saw that the cancers had shrunk by some degree with lenvatinib when everybody took it orally every day by about 63%. So people could actually have shrinkage of their tumor as compared to about 12% with the sorafenib. So what's important here is now we have two drugs that show very promising activity for the treatment of thyroid cancer. Sorafenib has now been approved for the treatment of thyroid cancers, and these are what they call papillary or differentiated thyroid cancers, not the medullary thyroid cancers. Those are treated with other medications. But with the differentiated or papillary or follicular thyroid cancers, sorafenib is now approved by the FDA, and lenvatinib will soon apply to the FDA for an approval. So soon we will probably have two agents that will be active and available. What's going to be important as we move forward, however, is to figure out exactly, like in kidney cancer and in liver cancer, when the agents should be given and how long they should be given. So clinical studies will still be important in the treatment of this orphan disease, meaning that we will look at a study comparing sorafenib up front followed by lenvatinib versus lenvatinib followed by sorafenib to see if we can prolong the duration of what they call the disease-free interval or the time the cancer doesn't grow. And we will also be looking at other agents or other drugs that may have benefit when these agents stop working. So those, in summary, are the abstracts that I'd like to share with you that were important from the head and neck oncology session. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Warden. A very comprehensive presentation on oral and head and neck cancer and updates from ASCO. Very important information for everybody on the call. Thank you so much. And our next speaker, and actually our final speaker today, is Dr. Gregory Daniels. Dr. Daniels is Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine, University of California, San Diego, Rebecca and John Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Daniels is going to present to you today really updates from ASCO on melanoma. And it's now my great pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Daniels.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner, and congratulations to everybody you're almost through the call. And this reminds me of how dizzy ASCO made me this year, just a tremendous amount of information, and I applaud you for staying with it. But I'm fortunate I get to just focus down on melanoma. So I'll briefly just introduce it by saying skin cancers are very common. Basal cells, squamous cells are the majority of cancers, and melanomas, while making up a small set of skin cancers, are focused on because they're the most deadly. In melanoma, cutaneous or skin melanomas are the most common. We have mucosal and ocular. Data was presented for both, but I'll focus on cutaneous. And the reason is incidence of melanoma is increasing. This is touching across age groups, across ethnicities and pigmentation rates in the skin. So people are paying attention to this. And fortunately, most melanomas are caught early where surgery leads to a cure, and I'll touch upon adjuvant treatment just briefly. The rest of my talk is going to be devoted to what happens for patients with advanced disease. And I certainly don't expect anybody to remember all the this versus that, but want to just give you enough information that you can ask the question appropriately of your care provider, what is the goal of my treatment? Because as things advance, and they have significantly over the last 5 years, our goals of quality of life, length of life, and even the chance of eliminating the cancer, our therapies are changing enough where the answers to these questions are changing. So the two general classes of treatments in melanoma have been touched upon already by the other cancers, and that's targeted therapies based on the cancer genetics and then immune modulators, which are referred to as this new pillar of cancer treatment. And it's a great time to be a discussant for melanoma because we've got great solid science that's driving both of these fields. For adjuvant treatment, historically it's been interferon, always been a tough sell with patients who go through a discussion of delaying time for the cancer to come back, but a significant quality of life impact. A study was presented from Europe with Dr. Eggermont showing a 900-patient study looking at a drug ipilimumab, an immune modulator, relative to placebo in high-risk patients. These are patients that were cured of their disease, but they have a risk of it coming back. And he was presenting initial results. ASCO is an exciting place, but a lot of the studies are ongoing or initial results. But it was clear this delayed the recurrence of melanoma in these high-risk patients. Discussion immediately turned to, well, how about overall survival and toxicity? Toxicity was, as expected, seen in this drug, and overall survival is going to be next year or the year after as data from this matures, and then we'll see how the standard matures. If melanoma does come back, the next question I'll just address is, you know, what is the next best or what is the best treatment for me? And while surgery and radiation may be part of that equation, I'm going to just talk about systemic treatments. Again, for targeted agents, we've had over the last couple of years several agents approved that inhibit growth pathways, particularly BRAF, which has changed in about 50% of the melanomas. We had a new drug approved this year for BRAF inhibition. We got updates on therapies showing that they continue to control disease, continue to improve survival, but data was expanded to non-BRAF mutated patients that have RAS mutations, and in these cases, about 15 to 20% of the patients. So now we're being able to address more and more patients on a targeted basis where the tumor genetics is picking out what cancer therapies we should be picking for our patients. And interesting results were presented by Jeff Sossman on inhibitors of MEK pathways or CDK4 and 6 that led to clinical benefit rates that were very high for patients. Shifting gears to the other side of immunologics or immune modulators, PD-1's been mentioned, and PD-1 was all over the board for melanoma, either as a single agent that Dr. Tony Rebus at UCLA presented, using it facetiously, a small phase 1, 411-patient study. Usually phase 1s are in the tens of patients. But this was a very complicated compilation of multiple treatments, again confirming what we saw last year, which PD-1 is a changer in the field. We're seeing response rates that are higher than immunologics in the past and survival rates that took the historical survival and extended it so far that some of the studies were not even seeing the median overall survival reported yet because the data has only been followed for 2 to 3 years. There's, again, a reminder for all of us that the toxicities from these drugs are a little different than the classic chemotherapies. Fatigue, rash, and itchiness that have been mentioned. Also, changes in other organs such as the thyroid or the colon that make education of patients, providers, and just the general public needs to be on these drugs. So pembrolizumab is going to be a game changer in melanoma and other cancers, and PD-1, I would just say stay tuned. PD-1, though, is just tip of the iceberg. We saw injectables that enhance the immune system either directly into tumors, as illustrated by T-VEC. This was a phase 3 study that met its primary endpoint of durable response, so patients with tumors that you can feel. You can inject in a virus into the tumors that cause regression and even appears to be a systemic change in the patient for changing the outcomes of patients. The nice thing about these type of agents is that their toxicity tends to be minimal. Local toxicity is usual, but systemic toxicities such as other autoimmune events are very uncommon. Combination was another theme going on, whether it's combinations of targeted agents or combinations of immunologics. I'll just give a shout out for a combination that was presented last year by Jed Wolchuk and then updated this year by Mario Snozel that showed PD-1 plus CTLA-4 blockade continues to show outstanding responses in melanomas. And we're understanding the biology of how these drugs are working, which ultimately is going to give us insight into how to combine these agents and how to pick out the patients, which is the current challenge. We have a wealth of drugs coming in, but which is the right drug for which patient, which drug should be combined with which ones? These are the challenges going forward. That's going to be based on, we saw new technology for pulling out circulating tumor DNA that gives you quantitations for what's going on in the tumor. This is going to be a great quality of life thing for patients where maybe we need to avoid biopsies in the future. Maybe we can get information out from just the blood, maybe a small finger stick. The microenvironment monitoring, we can do this now with small samples, but maybe we can do this with imaging in the future. So these are the challenges that we need to address, but they're being addressed now. We're moving from an era where all patients got one treatment. For example, all patients got chemotherapy, and you've heard kind of throughout this whole thing how we're tailoring our treatments to now patients are getting targeted agents based on hopefully more of what they need. So I'll just summarize that ASCO continues to be an outstanding meeting. It certainly is the nerd fest of oncology, so I don't expect everybody to get excited about this stuff, but really the whole field is changing, and one of the speakers said, we're writing history as we go, and that's how ASCO felt this year again, is that everything's in flux. We're learning how to de-escalate our therapies. We're learning how to target them better, and the goal of hopefully eliminating cancer as a major problem is actually starting to be realized. So I just want to thank you for your attention. Thanks, Cancer Care and Dr. Messner, for giving me this opportunity.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Daniels, for just an excellent, really outstanding presentation on melanoma and also a bit about the state of the field in terms of ASCO, what the wrap-up in terms of ASCO. And I want to thank all of our speakers today. They've really been extraordinary. I'm going to give you all a round of applause. You can't hear us, but you were just amazing. And we do have a part two to this series, actually, on June 12th, on Thursday. Many of you have signed up for it. And so please do, if you haven't, take advantage of it. And it will be covering another set of cancers on that date. Also, I do want to remind all of you that this is, of course, a one-hour education workshop. And in planning a program like this, or any of the workshops that we plan, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of this. Well, today was an hour and a half program, and usually our programs are an hour. And so I do want to remind you of the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Now, we have a staff of many oncology social workers here. All of them are professionally trained with master's degrees in social work and some with additional degrees as well. And they are available to provide a host of services to you, from practical and financial assistance to counseling services, which really is a chance to talk systematically to a professionally trained person who's there to listen to you and to listen to your concerns and to help you with problem solving. And we do that both one-on-one on the telephone or online. We also run a number of different support groups on the telephone and online as well. And all of that information is on our website, or you can call our 800 number at 1-800-813-HOPE, or our website is www.cancercare.org. And that's on all of your materials, of course. But we do want you to take advantage of these services. We also produce a number of booklets, and I do want to remind all of you that this whole program on the post-ASCO updates, the highlights from ASCO, is going to be made into a booklet. These two, both today's program and Thursday's program, will be combined in one booklet. And it usually takes us a few months to produce them, and all of you who have been on the call today will certainly get a copy of that booklet as well. We also have various fact sheets and other materials, all of which are available from Cancer Care for free. All of our services are free. And we have a very robust website, so we have lots of information, hopefully something for everyone. We also have a very active children's program and teen program helping children understand cancer in the family, a worksite program in which talking to people about their concerns about cancer in the workplace. So we have a number of programs for people to really help them with all the different aspects of coping with cancer. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're now part of a community of support and that we are here to help you. And we are also here for all the caregivers on the program and all the different people at all different ages in their cancer experience, from young adults throughout the entire spectrum to older adults. So really are here with programs for everybody, and we want you to take advantage of those services. So again, we don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with with cancer. We want you to know that you can connect with cancer care staff here, and we're here to help you. Again, thank you all for your participation. I look forward to your participation on Thursday and all of our other programs in June. We have quite a few, and please do check our website for all the programs that are coming up. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone, have a wonderful day.